Okay, we're recording the review Sefer Shmuel, Paul Smith 2019, just to make sure that goes on record. And the way this review works is essentially in two parts. Number one, more of the general stuff that you need to know for the exam, just the sort of overall questions that may come up about taking the exam, what you have to answer, etc., etc. So we'll spend a few minutes on that, and then go through the review sheet, giving you some, hopefully, major indications of where the exam will go, what you'll be doing. And always, the important thing to remember is that when you're reviewing and something comes up and you're not quite sure, please do not hesitate to email Reb Shaff at AOL, and I will get back to you, God willing, within a short period of time, hopefully within a day or two. This exam, I think, is my last exam. I do feel bad for you guys. I think it's on a Friday, if I'm not mistaken. 11:30 on a Friday morning. What can I say? What I would say to you is, this is my first comment. As hard as it is, and it doesn't give you much time to sort of go anywhere after that. I presume some of you will plan to be in the city for that Shabbos or whatever. The reality of it is that don't compromise your exam taking by making arrangements which, you know, make you finish the exam quickly or whatever, at the expense of those who've heard the story before. There was a student many moons ago who decided to travel to Israel after her exam, literally within an hour. It was 2 hours of finishing the exam. She finished at 3. And she booked a flight at 5 o'clock in the evening. This was obviously not a Friday night, but it was whatever it was, a Wednesday. And unless she had some sort of link to Star Trek or something like that, I was not quite sure how she was going to get from this part of New York to JFK in the time required, not only to check in and everything else, but to actually get on the plane. Remarkable. What did happen, which I thought was very sad, was that she really compromised her exam result. She basically did the whole thing in about 10 minutes instead of taking the required hour and a quarter, hour and a half, and ended up with a much lower grade. So it just wasn't worth it, right? With all the joys of going to Israel, I think that was a very bad arrangement. Not to go to Israel, but to do it in that way. So I would say to you, please just be sensible, intelligent, whatever. Don't compromise yourselves in terms of arrangements after the exam, right? Give yourself enough time to finish it. Those who have extra time, that will obviously be something that will be taken into account. Any special arrangements that you need to make in terms of taking the exam, if there's overlap or whatever, please speak to Dr. Katz. I cannot make those arrangements, but she does. And she's the exam person, the go-to person for this particular situation, so don't hesitate to speak to her. The general stuff about the exam, and some of you have heard this before, so if you want to have a little snooze for 5 minutes, you've heard it before, I have no problem with that. Number one, in terms of the number of questions, 6 questions on the exam, of which you have to answer 5, right? 5 and only 5, and not 5.5 or 6, but 5. I say that and I repeat it because there's no extra credits or anything like that. The idea is come in, do your 5 questions, right? Finish your paper, hand it in, sign your name, give me a smile, and leave. That's the whole idea of doing the exam and finishing it, because there's no heroics in this exam. Just get it done and you're out of here. The exam, as I said, is 2 hours officially. If you want to take the 2-hour period, that's fine. Usually, my experience is that people finish within, I don't know, hour and a quarter, hour and a half, some a bit less time, some a bit more. But that's the average time that people take, which is, again, absolutely fine. The books that they give you, these wonderful blue covered books, please don't hesitate to use as many as you need. I really do stress, that number one, you should not be writing on the covers of the books except the front cover with your name. And if you're using 2 books, book 1, and then put book 2 on the next one, but not to write answers on the blue covers. All right, I always remember this young lady, a very long time ago, who managed to do the impossible. She actually started to write her answer on the back cover, inside back cover of the blue book, finished it on the outside back cover of the blue book with about a millimeter to spare. It was amazing, absolutely incredible piece of work, but clearly not something that I was so excited about. I thought it was quite smart what she did, but not smart in terms of the instruction. The instruction is not to write on those covers. Please don't. I should have kept the book because it really was a work of art. The reality is that, again, even if you have, I don't know, one sentence to finish or whatever, don't hesitate to take a second book. These horrible books do seem to have a life of their own, and they reproduce quite prolifically, so I think it's quite a mitzvah to use them up. Yes? Yes, all of the topics from the review sheet will be appearing in one form or another in the exam. I will add that the idea is that not one review topic per question. It may very well be each question has three parts to each question. So you may have here a certain number of topics which appear as part of a question, right? Not the whole question. But they will definitely be making their appearance in one form or another. The point which I want to make, which is really important, is to read the questions carefully, as well as you will do in answering a question of three parts by answering two parts really well. But if you haven't answered the third part, I can't give you the points. I can't give you the extra, whatever it is, 6 or 7 points that you would get. And out of 20 points, you end up with 13 instead of 20. It's very frustrating because I know you know the answer, but you haven't written it. So please be careful and answer all sections of every question. If you want to combine A and B or B and C into one answer, just make it clear to me what you're doing, and that will also be acceptable, right? But ideally, you keep all the different answers separate, and again, using those blue books, if you do use one side of the page or both sides, it's up to you. Try and keep in the margins all the basic stuff, which I think, you know, probably does not need to be said, but I'm going to say it anyway because that's what we're doing. Yes.
Is there something in our notes that are not on the review sheet that we don't need to know?
No, I would say yes. It's going to be, this is like the guide, the overall guide. But for instance, my assumption is that you know the storyline. Now, I'm not going to go over the storyline in the review sheet. But if part of the answer will require you to talk a little bit about the actual storyline, obviously that's got to be included. All right?
If there's like a commentary?
Again, if you whatever it's as much or as little as you want to add in, right? If you find that you have something, even if it's your own suggestion, your own thought, part of the exam will be to get you to sort of come out maybe with your own opinion. That will be totally fine and does not have to just be what we've studied, but you can add your own ideas as and when called for, right? Sometimes I do ask opinion questions, and those are the ones I like because, you know, it shows me what you're thinking, how you're thinking, etc. As I said in my last class, my job in this place, I think one of my main tasks, although you may not appreciate it beginning, but I hope by the end, is to make you independent thinkers. I'm here just to present the information, and then you guys assimilate it, you take it in, and then you think about it, right? And this one sounds a bit more realistic than that, this one sounds right, this one sounds not so right. You make up your mind, not for me to tell you how to think, but it's for me to train you how to think, okay? And I think that should be really what every course in college is aiming towards, making you independent thinkers, which is what you're going to become in life. You'll be independent. You don't have, you know, once we start thinking all on the same lines and we all become monolithic, that's a really scary world. And hopefully that's not the world that you will occupy. Unless you're going to live in North Korea, but I suggest you don't do that. Yes?
Do we have to know who says what, like Red
Dog? No. If you can remember, wonderful, but it's not required, right? And believe it or not, that is my phone. Why is it? Excuse me one second. We're having alarms and phones. This is really a fun lesson. Okay. In terms of writing the exam, I always talk about again, another wonderful student whose name I've forgotten, who wrote her exam in what we used to call psychedelic pink. Psychedelic pink is a bit like someone's cover, Yael's cover over there, of your computer. That sort of mishmash of colours. Not just one, but the whole mishmash. It really looked very nice, looked very pretty, but was very difficult to read. Stick to the blues, stick to the blacks. If you want to use a pencil, then make sure it's a legible pencil. Don't write it in very light pencil, because then it becomes illegible and I can't read it. And for goodness sake, do not write it in a colour which I need to read in the dark, which, believe it or not, did happen once. Couldn't read it in the light, had to take it under the covers with me before I went to sleep, and all of a sudden, boom, it came to light. Remarkable event. Absolutely amazing. So please don't do that. You know, stay with the traditional blue and black and everything will be fine. You'll be amazed what goes on. It's really, I have to say these things, unfortunately. Well, maybe fortunately as well. The in terms of text, I really want to stress this. Bring a Hebrew-English translation. If you want to arrange between two of you to have one book between two, that's fine. If you, obviously, I'm not looking for people to communicate in the exam. That's not going to happen, as you know. But if the book is sitting between you or on your desk and somebody else wants to use it, that's absolutely fine. But it should be a simple translation, meaning, let's go through the list, the JPS and the Koran is good, and even the Art Scroll, the big blue, the green cover Art Scroll, not the blue one, the green cover Art Scroll, anything without commentary, but with the basic translation of the text is absolutely acceptable. I can't allow you to bring in the Judaica or the Art Scroll version of the commentary on the text, because there's literally too much commentary there. Again, you know, it's just one of those things you just can't bring into the exam. So that's, again, a very important thing. Why you would need the text is, again, not to write chunks of text, and you won't have time to do that, but every so often a phrase or a statement or something like that would be particularly useful in an answer. Not that I'm expecting it, but I would say to you, it certainly adds to the effect, the good effect that you would have on me as a teacher if you added the occasional Hebrew phrase. So it could be in English, right? A quotation from the text in English referring to something which, you know, obviously is relevant to your response to your answer. So I would say make sure that you have that with you, or access to a text. If you want to print out, I believe Chabad do a translation line for line as well. I don't have a problem with that. Anything which is literally Hebrew, English, and nothing else. Okay, that's the criteria. Again, I think that's more or less covered what I want to say about the exam. I'm just trying to think. Any questions? You have any comments?
But yeah. You said no commentary,
right? And not to bring in commentary. Your notebooks or all that stuff has
but
to be
English
left.
Is
yeah. Sorry?
English is okay.
English is fine. Hebrew, English, pure translation is absolutely fine.
So like this would be fine.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the green book. It even has a green cover. Look at that. Amazing. Remember the colour. Okay. Any other comments, any other questions? Alright, so let's get stuck into the review sheet. Let's see where we're going here. The background of Shmuel's birth, his unique parents, and the friction between the co-wives, Avera Lishma, and its application. All right, we did talk about, I didn't put it on here on the review sheet, but the Abarbanel's introduction, the whole concept of what Shmuel represents. Shmuel is the bridge. Okay, this is really important to remember. The bridge between the period of judges and the new period of kings. And what Shmuel does, which is so remarkable, is that he facilitates, love that word, he facilitates the transition between the two periods in Jewish history. There is a long period of judges. That period lasts for about nearly 400 years. And then we move to the period of kings. And what is so amazing is that the transition is more or less not 100% seamless, but it's about as good as it gets. And it's a very different style of leadership. All right. One of the things that we might have mentioned or were not have mentioned, but I'm hoping that you will sort of think about, are the differences between the king and the judge. The most obvious difference that we've learned when we started off with kings is that the king is dynastic. What do I mean by dynastic? Anybody? It passes from?
A generation to son.
Generations, father to son. To son, to son, to son. It goes down the line, right? The judges were not, I stress, were not dynastic. Okay? They were literally one-offs. And when that judge died, there was even a gap in certain periods in the period of judges when they had no judge. There was no concept of king is dead, long live the king. Never applied in the case of a judge. Okay? There were other things, differences as well. There were limitations which were put onto the king. No, not too many wives, not too many horses, not too much gold and silver, etc., which seemingly, in the case of the judge, was not such a major problem. There were judges who had many wives, right? Or as one king who had a lot of wives, but generally speaking, they stuck to the rules at the beginning. When it comes down to the judges, they did not have the same restrictions. Because again, it was not anything more than a one-off. Every time a judge was appointed, it was a one-off, and when the judge died, very often there was a break for a very long time, long period of time before the next judge comes along. One of the things that the king had to be was, for instance, anointed. Judges do not have to be anointed. All right, the king had to be anointed by a river. Judges do not have to go to the river in order to become a judge. So there are a number of areas where the kings and the judges were essentially doing the same job of judging the Jewish people, of controlling, but the focus of kingship was much more in terms of a long-term arrangement. Where it comes to judges, it was very much more of a, let's use the term, short-term arrangement. All right? And most judges did not stay around for that long. I'm trying to think of time periods. You'd have to look back in the book of Shoftim. It gives you some idea how long judges were around, but not really for that long. Shmuel's birth. What are we going to say about his parents? We're talking about Chana that everybody knows about, and I'm always intrigued that, and I'm very glad that many people wrote about the whole question of Chana's tefillah and her, what she was like, etc., etc., because I left that side of things a bit open. But what we do, what I hope has become a bit of a revelation in our study, is to find out not so much about Shmuel's mum, but to find out about Shmuel's dad, right? Elkanah. What do we say about Elkanah? What was the challenge of Elkanah? What was the good side? And what was the, how should we say, the less good side of Elkanah? Anybody remember what I'm talking about? Right? What did we say was the good thing about Elkanah? Yes, please. He was the guy who brought people back to the Mishkan, to the temple, right? He went around the country and he would start the whole thing, the whole ball rolling in different areas, come and spend Yontov in the Mishkan. What a wonderful thing to do. And he got people to come and he started with his family and then he went to his friends and then his friends of friends. And eventually he must have encouraged thousands of people to go and be connected to the Mishkan. Good guy, as I would say in my country, good bloke, good chap. But at the same time, very challenging. What was the challenging part of his existence, Elkanah, was?
That he would like end up favoring Chana.
Exactly. The relationship that he had with Chana as opposed to, what was her name? Penina. Good. And what was specifically annoying when Chana has this crying session, one after the other, for years, what was so incredibly upsetting about it? Yeah, go on.
To her, am I not, like, handsome?
Yeah, he comes along, and in the way that nowadays would be called rather chauvinistic, to put it mildly, he says, am I not better for you? I'm adding the word bubala. Am I not better for you, bubala, than 10 sons? The word bubala is not in the text. Please don't quote me. But, you know, he's having a very intimate conversation with Hannah, trying to calm her down, and she's crying, and it's not happening, she's not getting pregnant, she's not having a child, and he looks at her and he says, but you got me, Shayna, you got me. And the answer is that he doesn't get it, right? And I really believe that. He, with all due respect, he may have been this wonderful person when he came to understanding his wife, understanding the pain that Hannah was going through. He doesn't seem to have had a clue. For him to say, I'm better for you than, am I not better for you than 10 sons? You know, any husband who says that today in a situation, God forbid, where people are childless, he's not going to have a very good reception from anybody. And I would argue that that is the challenge of Elkanah. Elkanah, again, we're all not, none of us are perfect. So we've got a side of Elkanah which is so inspiring. Wow, remember that handout that you got at the beginning with how he generates the enthusiasm for the Beit HaMikdash. But at the same time, there are challenges in his character. And you know what? That's what it's all about. Life is full of these situations. And unfortunately today, I can only say that to me it rings bells with what goes on today when, you know, we just, as they say, we don't know what goes on behind closed doors. We really don't. And we see very often situations develop. All of a sudden you hear of a couple getting divorced and you said, wow, they were the most perfect couple I've ever met. And you just don't know what the relationship was really like when it came to, you know, one-on-one when they were on their own. You just don't know. And that's why it's realistic. There's a realistic analysis going on here of Elkanah, which I think really makes sense. Putting all that to one side, I would suggest, however, that in terms of Shmuel's influences from his parents, it makes perfect sense that Shmuel becomes who he becomes. He's got the very deep religious commitment of Hannah. He's got the very practical religious commitment of Elkanah. And what I like so much about this whole introduction is the fact that he understands that you've got to go to the people. You have to be out there. Right? I mean, it's almost an advert for Chabad, but different. The reality is he's got to go out there and he's got to go around the country, which is what he does. And he's got to be there for the people, not that they should come to him, but he has to go to them. And the problem, of course, is that by leaving his family, the children are not getting the influence eventually, which they should be getting. Shmuel's sons do not live up to their father's reputation. That happens in life. And again, very practical. You can have the most incredible dad, the most incredible man who does all of this fabulous, this is the word that we all use, kirov, brings everybody closer to God, and yet the family doesn't seem to reflect it. If anything, there's a lot of tension and issues, and it happens, right? So all of this with Shmuel is very down to earth. It really, I would say, almost to the point of painful realism going on here. So all of what we're saying on number one is the background of Shmuel. The friction between the two women is obviously very much a discussion that we had. And we did talk about Aveira Lishma. Aveira Lishma is one of those very strange concepts in Talmud. And the concept is a very simple but very challenging concept that there can be a situation where you may, I'm not going to say allowed, but you may find yourself doing a sin for the sake of God in a circumstance where the Gemara puts it, it's better to do that than a mitzvah not for the sake of God. Right? Aveira lishma before mitzvah shelo lishma. But there are conditions attached. Aveira lishma is only something which refers or has any connection with the whole of the Jewish people. Right? Shmuel and what his influence is going to be on the whole of the Jewish people is something which is significant in the relationship between Hannah and Penina. Penina is taunting Hannah the whole time. Comes home from, you know, whatever story it is, babies are us, and she's waving that onesie in the air and says to Penina, says to Hannah, where is your child? I want to put this on your child. And Hannah looks at him and says, what are you talking about? I can't conceive. I can't have children. And Penina is being very challenging, aggressive. And Hannah is crying her eyes out. And everybody is very mystified about this, to the point where eventually Hannah is blessed with children, not only Shmuel but others. And the tragedy for Penina was that Penina was punished. That every time Hannah had one, Penina lost two. till eventually you got to the... And Penina had 10 children, and 8 of them died. The last two, it says, they survived because Chana took them over as, like in loco parenta, she became the mother instead of Penina, counted as the mother. And the question which we tried to analyze was what's going on with Penina. On the one hand, she means incredibly positive thoughts. She directs them towards Chana. But the way she goes about it is what we're calling Avera. It's a sin, Lishma, for the sake of God. She knows, she seems to have an inkling, as one of the commentaries says, she's a tzedekah, she's a righteous woman. She knows that Shmuel has to come about, there has to be someone from Chana and Elkanah who's going to be changing the world. But the way she goes about it, the way she taunts Chana to daven and to daven with her heart and soul is very, very distressing. And her methodology is really challenging. And we have to say that, again, it's an Avera sin which she's committing, but for the sake of God. She knows that Shmuel is going to be someone who's going to save the Jewish people. He's going to transition them from Shoftim, which is a very unsatisfactory position, into the position of kings, which was potentially the greatest situation for the Jewish people. They were told it's a big mitzvah to have a king. However, the way that Penina did it was very, very, let's put it this way, very difficult. And as a consequence, Penina is punished. So it's one of those things, a very lishma, there are examples, for instance, Esther and Achashverosh and Eliyahu Navi with the Mount Carmel story. Everything that they did, even though it was committing a sin, Esther staying with Achashverosh at the end of the Purim story is quite shocking, because they have a child together, right? And she is, according to the Gemara, she's married to Mordechai, so actually go off with this non-Jewish guy, no matter who he is. And the answer is because that child is going to allow the Jews to build the second temple. It's for the sake of the Jewish people. And when Eliyahu goes on Mount Carmel and brings a fire down from heaven, totally forbidden to have a sacrifice outside the temple, according to Jewish law, but it's for the sake of the Jewish people. It's to make the impression on the people living in the north of Israel that you can't ignore the God of Israel. You can't turn around and just carry on being idolatrous. So all of the sins that we read about, the big ones, which seem to be without explanation, very often, not always, but very often revolve around this concept, Avera Lishma. Any questions? Because I think this is really important, what we just said. This is all in number one, the first item. But it's pretty significant that Avera Lishma is a concept. Again, remember the rule for the sake of Am Yisrael. Can't just go along and say, I'm going to have this cheeseburger for the sake of the Jewish people, because that's not exactly what it's talking about. Right? Maybe for your own sake, if you want to eat such a thing, but not for the sake of Am Yisrael, and therefore not called Avera Lishma. Any questions or else we're moving on? Alright, number two. The question of Psak Halacha by Shmuel. What happened? Shmuel comes along as a little kid and he's standing in the temple, and what happens next is quite unbelievable. Right? The Kohanim are out to lunch. So what does Shmuel say? Shmuel says, where are they? Everyone is getting antsy because they can't bring their sacrifices. Right? So what does Shmuel say to his dad? I just learned in Hebrew school that sacrifices can be done by anybody. Don't have to wait for Mr. Cohen to come back, whatever his name is. We can do it. And Elkanah is very taken with what Shmuel has said. And the next thing you know, Eli HaKohen is absolutely livid. He's livid with Shmuel, and he says to Chana that Shmuel deserves the most severe punishment possible. Right, which essentially is to be put to death, which is pretty shocking. And the reason why he says it is because, and that was a whole analysis that we did, the whole concept of Eli's authority was undermined, the whole concept of what Shmuel was trying to do was very noble, but not necessarily, you know, at the right time and the right place. Shmuel was definitely, even though he was so young, he exhibited signs of maturity, but at the same time, it was problematic. Deciding a halachic issue in front of his Rebbe. And we had a whole discussion about it. Although the Radak, Rav David Kimchi, in his commentary says this whole story is very far-fetched, but the reality was that the story explains one of the psukim, chapter 1, verse 25, if I'm not mistaken, where the pasuk doesn't make sense unless you realize that's the story behind the pasuk. Right? Pasuk talks about slaughtering the animal and then going to Eli. And it's unclear why after slaughtering the animal they had to go into Eli, but once you hear the story you understand. Eli called for Shmuel because of what Shmuel had told everybody, go and slaughter the animal, don't need a Kohen, and Eli saw this as a breach of the code. He saw this as a wrong behavior and was prepared to be very strict. And Chana has to beg Eli for forgiveness. And Eli eventually says, fine, he gives in. But boy, it's a very, very amazing and rather disturbing story, perfectly honest. It's not an easy story. So that's the story of the Psak Halacha of Shmuel. We did also, I forgot to mention about Chana's Neder, one point that we did make, that what was the vow, right? We had a whole analysis of that, because we said, if you remember, the vow doesn't make sense. She vows to bring Shmuel to the temple to work in the temple. But Shmuel's going to do it anyway, he's a Levi, right? So what do you mean you're vowing him to be a worker of the temple? He's a Levi. He's going to work in the temple whether he likes it or not. That's his job. So what are you making a vow? What's your promise? So we saw that in fact there are different interpretations on what the vow was, and understanding the whole story, whether Chana could make such a promise on the existence of Shmuel or not. Shmuel was not yet in existence, he wasn't around yet, so was Chana allowed to make such a commitment? And we saw that one suggestion is that it's a commitment on herself, that eventually when Shmuel is born, her commitment will be to bring Shmuel maybe earlier in his life than he would have done otherwise, taking him to the Mishkan. So look at the note that we had, we did a lot of analysis of that. Yeah. Aver Lishma with Chana and Penina, the two wives. Penina literally does stuff to Chana which is unforgivable. She holds up baby clothes. Chana is crying to have a child, and Penina is teasing her. I've got children, and you haven't. I've just been to the store, and I've just bought a whole bunch of diapers. Where is your child that I can put the diaper on? And Chana is sitting there crying her eyes out. And everybody says, wow, Penina, talk about being slightly aggressive. It's really unacceptable. And the argument is, to explain Penina's strange behavior, is that she thought that this was a good example of Avira Lishma. I know that I'm doing something wrong, but I'm doing it for the sake of the Jewish people. We've got to get a Shmuel out of it. Right? Who's going to change the world? The answer is, yeah. You'll get a Shmuel out of it, but there's ways of doing it which are good, and ways of doing this which unfortunately are not so good. So her choice of how to go about it was really unfortunate. It's an unbelievable story. I mean, but you know, you think about the mindset of those people, it's very different to the way we would deal with it today. But these are tzaddikim. Yeah.
But how did she know that they were getting Shmuel?
Well, again, she understood that there's something unique going on here. For Chana to stand and daven the way... And remember, what did Eli say about her? He thought she was Kasara, right? Or rather, he misinterpreted, but the message was she's like Sarah. She's Kashera. She's a very kosher woman. So, and her tefillah and everything about it, Penina could not in any way sort of judge the situation except to say something unique is going to come out of this. She can't be standing davening for 20 years and nothing happened, right? You know, and therefore, Penina understood that maybe with a little bit of extra cajoling, a little bit of extra pushing, that might just tip the whole thing over the edge. Unfortunately it did, but it did backfire on Penina as well. Right? It's a very strange story. It's a really tough story that she should tease her by holding up baby clothes. I mean, you know, how inconsiderate. It's almost as inconsiderate as, if you want to pardon the expression, as Elkanah saying, you know, aren't I like 10 sons? I'm better for you than 10 sons. I mean, again, not understanding, seemingly, although Elkanah really did not understand, seemingly, whereas Penina did, but she still pushed it in a very, very severe way. Very severe. You know, this is, again, you know, we have to look at it from all sides, which is what we're trying to do.
Wait, did we talk about what Elkanah said?
Yeah, Elkanah doesn't really say more than that. He just, says to says to Chana, I'm here, but I'm here for you, and that's all he says. And of course, it's not really understanding; it's not enough. Elkanah tends to take a back seat in most of the story after that, even when the story with the Psak Halacha, which we just spoke about, where Shmuel gives this opinion, and he's a little kid, Elkanah doesn't seem to get involved in trying to save Shmuel. It's all about Chana. The women are much more involved with the children than the men. And that's true. We just had in Malachim Bet, in my other class, talking about that with the Shunamim. Remember the whole story with the boy that died, and who is involved with trying to bring the boy back? Elisha is the prophet, but who takes the boy to Elisha? The mother. The father doesn't seem to be even remotely caring about what's going on. So it seems to be, something about maybe the Middle East of those days. I don't know. And that in itself is an interesting discussion, but not for now. Number three, the calling of Shmuel. This wonderful story when he's called three times. The definition of prophecy, Rambam and Abarbanah. So what did we say? According to the Rambam, Maimonides, prophecy can and always is in an indirect way. It's like in a dream, a trance, whatever it may be. Right? And Rambam has issues explaining that particular story in chapter 3 of Shmuel Aleph. But according to Barbanel, he disagrees. He says that prophecy can be the voice of prophecy. It comes direct, right? As a sound, as a voice. And between the two opinions, we did do a whole analysis. I hope you've got that particular item sort of written down, because it is kind of interesting. How is prophecy to be understood? Is it always indirect, which is the Rambam's definition, except for Moshe Rabbeinu? He was the only one who got it direct. Everybody got it indirect. Whereas, according to the Abarbanel, he says there are circumstances where a voice would be heard direct by people like Shmuel. He did hear the voice of Hashem, or whatever, however one can say that. So there is an interesting argument about the nature of prophecy, the nature of the calling of Shmuel. So that chapter is the most beautiful chapter, one of the most beautiful chapters in the whole Tanakh, chapter 3, and has this issue of definition in dealing with it. Yeah.
So then for Rambam, how would that apply to Shmuel?
To Shmuel, again, what would have happened is, again, not a direct voice, but an indirect voice. And of course, and Barbanel takes him to task. He says the story doesn't read like that. Right, so remember we had a whole handout about it. We did go into it, which I'm not going to go through now, but it's certainly available for you to look at. It's the Abarbanel on that particular story. Abarbanel was a cool guy. He really was very cool for many reasons. I always find talking about him very different, because he was a man of principle. Right, he was in Spain. He was told that he could stay behind. All the Jews are being thrown out, but he can stay because he's high up in the government. And he turned around and said to the king and queen, if they are going, I'm going. These are my people. And, you don't find many people like that in life. It really is something. Number four, the lesson of the capture of the Oran. That's really shut. I'm not really looking for more than that. And it may become relevant as an item in a question. Chapters 4-7, right? The travels of the Ark. Where is the lost Ark of Israel? Right? Where did it go? It went to the Philistines, came back, and the problems that happened. The whole story is really very, very unusual. And just know the story. It may be useful for answering any sort of question. That may come in as a kind of item you can refer to. Appointment of a king is really one of the biggest. What was the big issue between the people asking for a king and the reaction of Shmuel and the initial reaction of God saying no, or rather, let's put it this way, being upset. Alright, Shmuel was desperately upset about the request, so we went through a number of explanations that on the one hand, and this I want you to know, there is a text which I gave you all from Sefer Shoftim, which says categorically there's a mitzvah to have a king. Alright, but I did explain, and we did go through the commentary of the Netziv, very famous rabbi of Lithuanian origin, 1900s, late 1800s, and the Netziv says quite clearly, yes, there is a mitzvah to have a king, but it depends on the will of the people. If the people want it, then they should have it. If they don't want it, or they haven't asked for it, then you don't go and produce it. And part of the issue is about the fact that the people have to make the request. Okay? And that's one of the issues of kingship, of the definition of kingship, which is very unusual. It's mandated by God on the basis of the will of the people. And the Tziv talks about countries where a republic is much more acceptable. In other words, no monarchy, and other countries who need a monarch. Okay, and therefore the whole question was, when the Jews asked for a king, were they in a position where they needed the monarch? And of course, that's a debatable subject, because Shmuel was of the opinion they don't need a monarch. They got me. You want someone to daven for you? I'm here. I'm here for the Jewish people 24/7. He said, literally 24/7. And says Hashem, as a response to Shmuel, yes, you're right, but once the people have made the request has to be honored. We saw one opinion who made that remarkable statement that part of the problem was the people wanted a secular system of law. Not only a Jewish law, but they wanted secular law to apply. And that was part of the problem. That pasuk, right, when it says, we want a king, l'shofteinu k'chol ha'goyim. Okay, chapter 8, I think it's pasuk 5, if I'm not mistaken. That's one of the good pasukim to be aware of, because obviously, remember, it was all about how you read the pasuk as to what was going on over there. And be aware of the nuance of that pasuk. Can be read as a request to have a Jewish king, or it could be read as a request to have a king like all of the non-Jews, meaning a king who would bring in laws like the non-Jewish kings, right? So therefore, the issue, one of the commentaries says, is that the rejection was initially because it might have been a move to bring in secular law. And that was unacceptable. Yeah.
Which pasuk is that written in?
It's pasuk hey, I think it's verse 5 of Perek Chet. And that's really the key pasuk when it comes to discussing this particular item. Yeah, Galia. Well, again, we did say part of the issue was also it was a premature request. It was at the wrong time. That's one suggestion. But another suggestion is that the whole request was invalid because of the way it was stated had the implication that they wanted to change the legal system. And changing the legal system was clearly unacceptable. Right? They were bound by the Torah. They're not bound by Hammurabi or anything else that was going on at the time. Right? So therefore, to bring in secular law, which was part of the implication of the request, was initially rejected by Shmuel, and God says in the end, Shmuel, you have to accept their request. They really just want a military king, and the fact that they speak and ask for it, you have to follow that. That's what we learn from the Torah chapter itself about kings. There is a mitzvah, but it depends on the people. And again, what does that mean? If they ask for it, yes. If they don't, it's like a mitzvah of tzitzis. Tzitzis is not that you have to put the fringes into the corners, but if you have a four-corner garment, you've got to put tzitzis. It's what is called mitzvah kiyumin. When you have the garment, then you have to put in the tzitzis. But you don't have to go to get the garment. You can have a three-corner garment and never have tzitzis. You don't need it. You see what I'm saying? It's one of those mitzvahs that come about when it comes about. But not that I have to go and do it like I have to put on tefillin, or I have to light Shabbos candle, or whatever. All those mitzvahs you have to do. When it comes to the rule of king, it's a mitzvah which becomes practical when the people ask for it. So it may never come about, or it did come about. You know, that was just one of those doubtful cases, a suffix, a doubt. Well, again, the answer is both, because there are different views. Okay, and what we saw is a whole range of views. We saw different commentary. One of the great things about learning commentaries is that you begin to understand that nothing is written in stone. And it makes it interesting because it means that I can have an opinion as well. Right? Why shouldn't I have maybe my own view on this? It may reflect Rashi, it may reflect the Radak, it may reflect the Ralbam, it may reflect nobody. It doesn't matter, because that's the beauty of studying Torah. We all have a portion in Torah, and that's one of the great things that we come out from studying commentary. It's really a beautiful thing. The choice of Shaul, big question about that. He's from the wrong tribe. So what did we say? Yeah, he's the wrong tribe, but he's the right guy. Right? At that moment when they needed a king, Shaul was the right person for the job. But what is the issue with Shaul? His name gives it away. What does the word Shaul mean? Translation of the word Shaul, ani Shael Mimcha, I can make a question, but it also means to borrow. He's a borrowed king. He's not the ultimate and final dynasty that will take over. Right? Shaul is literally filling in the gap. At the time when they needed a king, especially a military leader, Shaul was available, and he was, it says, head and shoulders above everybody else. We learn a lot about his character, his midot. Remember the story chasing after the donkeys, what he had to do. His kibbutz av in that case was incredible. Shaul was a big tzaddik, no question about it. And one of the tragedies really of learning the story of Shaul is how, as they say, naflu, as David HaMelech put it, he said, Ech naflu gibarim, how the mighty have fallen. He was talking about when they died, but clearly that applies when they lived. There was this issue that as great as they were, they really fell down. And Shaul is clearly one of those cases. So again, whole discussion about whether, we did say that when the verse says that all the kings come from Yehuda, so how could you have Shaul? The answer, one of the answers we said was that, yeah, the advice is that Yehuda will be a leader, not necessarily always to be the king. Yehuda will be the tribe that everybody looks up to. But can we have a king from another tribe? This was all of Barbanel. Barbanel said, yeah, you can. And that's what we did. We started off with Shaul. He was from the tribe of Binyamin, significant because Binyamin had been wiped out almost to zero because of the story at the end of the book of Shoftim, the Plegesh Begivah, and now Shaul became the representative of Israel to become the king from the tribe, that same group of people, the tribe of Binyamin. So there's something really significant about it. The farewell speech, the sign, chapter 12. Please make sure you know chapter 12. One of the big issues that we saw, again, from the Barbanel, was the message of the rain in the summer. All right, Shmuel was saying that I know you wanted a king, and I know in the end of the day God granted it, but you should know, and this is something that we spoke about, that there is a very big issue in free will. Free will means that God is committed to whatever the human being chooses to do. Right? That's the Abarbanel's Chiddush. He says that the idea, although we believe in Ashgacha Pratit, there is divine providence, divine control, but there is this concept that you make the choices. You drive the engine. Okay? You plot your path in life. And although God knows what you're going to choose, you still have the autonomy to be able to make those choices. And the problem with that, and this is something that we spoke about, is in terms of human beings making bad choices. Or making, let's be extreme, evil choices. Why was God not there in the concentration camp when Jews were being slaughtered left, right and center? The answer is, because that's not the way God functions in the world. I always believe this was the answer to the question, one of the answers. God does not mix in with us because by definition, God is committed to man's free choice. So if man chooses to be the most evil, disgusting person that has ever lived, as so many of those Nazi brutes were, the reality is that in the laws of free will, Hashem is committed to free will existing, happening. That's the commitment. What we obviously have to learn from it is that when it comes to free choice, obviously we want to make the right choices as opposed to the wrong choices. What is our guide? Very much our lifestyle, our religion, our beliefs, everything that we grow up with, that guides us hopefully to make good choices. But God is committed to free will, whether we choose good or whether we choose bad. So that was what Shmuel was saying. You know what? You chose a king and Hashem went along with it, even though at the time it was maybe a bad choice. meaning not to choose Sha'ul, but just generally to want a king. It was premature. As we said just now, the reality was, says Shmuel, Hashem goes along with it because Hashem respects man's free choice. Right? So again, we spoke about that. Please be aware of the implication of what was saying, because it really is quite interesting. Try to get through this. Yonatan's behavior, because I haven't got much time. The attack against the enemy, Nichush. Remember, we spoke all about that particular discussion of whether it was allowed to make those signs that if the enemy comes out of the camp or the enemy stays in the camp, are you allowed to rely on that? Right? There is a problem in the Torah which is called Nichush. You're not allowed to make these divinations, as they're called. And what was going on with Yonatan, the bottom line, as we said, we learned this a few weeks ago, two weeks ago, we said that the bottom line of Yonatan was his choice was based on logic. When you have a choice based on logic, this was the comment of Rabbeinu Nissim Maran, famous commentary of the Middle Ages. He said, when it's logical, it's not Nichush. Nichush is when you talk about black cats crossing your path, things which don't make sense, they're not logical, then it becomes superstitious. Right? And maybe think about why people are superstitious. Very interesting. Particularly certain generations of Jews, right? I always quote my grandmother, both grandmothers, who would say the word Kenenahor at least 25 times every single day. Don't ask me why they did that, but that was the world that they came from, which was, interestingly, quite a superstitious world. Not to, the expression we would use, Beli Ayin Hara. But in Yiddish it's called the same word, Kenenahor. No Ayin Hara. Ayin Hara, superstition. Maybe more than that, but I don't know. I don't think so. I don't know. And what is that all about, right? And that's something, again, which we did speak about.
Were
yes.
there like a few different commentaries
on? Yeah, yeah, we did.
But this is the main conclusion of all of them?
Yeah, yeah. But have a look. Again, I gave out a hand. Yeah, I think that if there's any discussion, it would be worth sort of elaborating on the point, right? And there is a very clear handout on that. Sha'ul's behavior with Amalek, why he lost the kingship and David not, what we spoke last time. Sha'ul sins and David sins. Sha'ul does it once, David does it twice. And what did we say? Sha'ul failed in his job as king. David was sinning as a human being, but not necessarily as a king. But more than that, where was the big difference between David and Sha'ul? Not in the sin, but in the, somebody say the word, in the Hebrew teguvah, in the reaction to the sin. The way Sha'ul reacted was very much apologetic. I didn't mean it. I didn't do anything wrong. He tries to find an excuse. When David is confronted with the truth, what does David do? Chatati. He starts saying vidui. Immediately. I did something wrong. I should have not done it. So David is this amazing individual who, as a leader, and believe me, it's so rare. We'll just look what's going on in the government here at the moment, it's so rare when someone is called out on a specific issue to stand up there and say, Chatati, I sin, admit it. And the answer is, not in the world we live in today, but once upon a time, there were leaders like that, and boy, were they significant. And David HaMelech, David Chai V'Kayim, is still with us. His lessons are with us for today. The overall comments on the Sefer, the authorship, the message, the ideas, these are all things which I think everything we've said today can answer the last point on the review sheet. Alright? The ideas, the message of Sefer Shmuel, particularly, I love the concept of being inspired to go and raise the situation. You know, elevate the community. Right? The whole thing with Elkanah at the beginning, and really that's what Shmuel is all about. Shmuel is there to be the bridge, to create the new situation of Melech. And it's not easy. It's a transition which is really, really tough. And to be perfectly honest, he does a pretty good job of it. Alright? There are high points and there are low points. Shmuel is desperately unhappy what happens with Sha'ul when he fails to kill Amalek and to go through with the whole thing. And that's the sadness that we saw at the end. But the reality of it is, there are incredibly inspiring things to read and inspiring people to learn about. Right? They may have been gone now for a long time, but their lessons, their morals, their their ethics, their midas, everything about them is still with us to this very day. I really like that idea, as you can see. Any questions, any final comments, please?
You mentioned about, in the farewell speech number 7, about yeah. the message of rain in summer.
Yeah.
Can you like expand on
that? Yeah, again, because it was so out of place. So what Shmuel is doing is making it rain in the summer to prove to the Jewish people either that he is still able to make it rain. So his tefillah is very powerful. Why do you need a king? I can snap my fingers and it rains, right? Or, as we said, he's giving them a lesson of the way God functions in this world. And by making it rain, even though it shouldn't have rained, is the idea that Hashem will allow things to happen, even if they shouldn't. You go to Israel in the summer, you don't need an umbrella, you don't need a raincoat, you don't bother taking it with. And yet, in this case, it rained, and it poured. And the answer is because Shmuel is teaching a lesson, essentially through the words of the Abba Benel. Shmuel is teaching a lesson to the Jewish people, always be aware that when you choose badly, Hashem will, as it were, almost step back and allow your choices to happen. And unfortunately, if they're bad choices, bad consequences. And that's the whole story of the kingship. Kingship eventually becomes one after the other of bad choices. Okay? And of course, as I'm trying to suggest, this is a philosophical issue. The issue of what is called, one word for it is called theodicy. How God interacts with the world around us in terms of judgments and justice. Is it fair? Should it have happened? Why didn't God get involved? And the answer is because that's not the way the world works. Right? If every time we did something wrong, we got a bolt from heaven, go back to, you know, square one, that would not be you couldn't survive like that. Right? But it's very hard to come to terms with the fact that Hashem will allow it to happen. We want God to intervene, but he doesn't. And that's a historical issue which we still, you know, we struggle with. Really struggle with it. Final comments, 1 and 2.
Sorry, are we allowed to have a new
quote? Yes, Hebrew only, totally okay. Allowed. Yes, I'm very happy with that. Should have mentioned that. Thank you for bringing that up. Yes.
We could have like a Bible now that comes in the name of Adonai.
Yeah. If but, you want a Mikra Gedolot, Hebrew only, yes, absolutely.
Okay, what about like the blue art scroll?
No, that one I'm not allowed because again, too much commentary.
If we bring Mikra Gedolot, can we highlight stuff?
Again, if you want to highlight bits, yeah, absolutely fine. Right? I might be shocking you with that answer, but on the other hand, you know, I think to myself, why not? There's no reason why not. But to have the English commentary, that's a little bit giving a bit too much, right. You know, in the exam. That I think I've
Can
drawn the line.
Can we bring Mikro-Gadolot
and this? If you want to bring two books, yeah, but you know, your case will get a bit heavy if you start schlepping lots of books.
Okay.
But you know what I'm saying. Whatever you really want to do, have no problem. Final comment. It was a comment.
Yes,
and JPS for sure. You'll find them around the building. Sorry?
Hebrew only, basically.
If you've got the Hebrew only, you have like the Tanakh from Israel, you know, the one that's got Hebrew translation in Hebrew, that's also fine. But in terms of commentary, no. But Mikra Gedolot, Hebrew only, I'm happy to allow. That's fine. Because again, this exam is not about Hebrew skills as much as it is about concepts. And Hebrew English, just the bare translation.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm getting too complicated at this point, trying to confuse you, but it's all good fun.
Can we put tabs in the
program? You want to put tabs? Good Lord, you're pushing the envelope over here. The answer is yeah, why not? Yeah. Yeah, you can tab it.
Can you bring all the pages you gave us?
No. They're already. Bring your Rebbe, you know, bring whatever, you know, bring your high school teacher. There's a limit to what we can allow. Okay, but if you want to bring him along, I mean, whatever. Him or her. Bakasha. Two things I want to say before you go. Again, number one, of all the groups, I always like this group. It's the later group in the day. Please listen for a second, sorry. It's the group I enjoy teaching probably the most for the simple reason the time one's a bit sort of more relaxed. I always find it's a more relaxing lesson to do a bit later in the day, a bit more chilled. But more to the point, the way that you've responded has been really quite magnificent. Enjoyed your essays very much. Look forward to seeing some of you again next semester. I know classes are being closed out already, which is driving me crazy, but that's the way it goes. But more to the point, I want to just say a big thank you to everybody. I learned so much from you guys, you've got no idea. And wish everybody a great Shabbos. Good luck in the exam. Really good luck. Thank you.